From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Food allergies in children and adults have more than tripled in the last few decades. Many of these allergies are life-threatening, but there is no clear agreement on why or how to treat them. As nuts, lactose, and other common offenders are being banished from school cafeterias, EpiPens, the preferred treatment, are filling up nurses' offices. What is the best treatment for allergy patients? And what's the responsibility of parents, teachers, friends, and lawmakers to help keep kids safe? This hour On Point, food allergies on the rise. You can join us, listeners. Does your child have food allergies? What are the biggest daily challenges? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Wayne Schreffler, a pediatrician and director of the Food Allergy Center at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, principal investigator at Center for Immunology and Inflammatory Diseases, also at Mass General, professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Schreffler, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Jane. Great to be here.
Also joining me from Chicago, Illinois, is Dr. Ruchi Gupta, professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and a clinical attending physician at the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Dr. Gupta, welcome to you.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jane.
So we'll start with you, Dr. Gupta. Help us understand the data. How many children in this country have food allergies?
Yes. Now, I'm happy to set the stage. So as you said, food allergy is increasing in the United States. And currently, 8% of children have a food allergy. Now, that's 1 in 13 kids, or 2 per classroom. In addition, over 30% of these kids have more than one food allergy, so they're avoiding multiple foods. And as you said, you know, we have a top eight. There are eight foods that are the most common, and those include peanut, milk, shellfish, tree nut, egg, finfish, wheat, and soy. Kids can be allergic to much more than this, but those are the most common.
Mm-hmm. So 8% of children, 1 in 13, 2 per classroom. Put that into perspective for us. I mean, compared to years past, what are the trends?
So the trends are increasing, and I think anyone, you know, with children or around children can see that it's just becoming much, much more common. And in addition, you know, what I think is really critical to understand is food allergies can be so severe. And so it's so important in the classroom or for kids to have everyone really understand what a food allergy is, what the symptoms are, what can happen if a child ingests a food by accident, and what they can do to take care of that child.
We'll talk about a lot of that during this hour. Dr. Schreffler, what's changed in your patients over the years? What are you seeing now as far as food allergies that you didn't see 5, 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I would say certainly the frequency. So, you know, and you really get this when you talk to the parents and they say, you know, this just wasn't an issue when, you know, when I was a child. Why is this so common now? Or, you know, I didn't have any allergies myself, or I had only some hay fever or asthma. You know, why is my child have food allergy? And that just seems to be growing anecdotally, certainly with, you know, some data, as Dr. Gupta mentioned, behind that. I think, on the other hand, there are some good things that have changed. I mean, I think that awareness has increased. There is more legislation to help families cope with it a little bit better. So, you know, it's been sort of a mix of an increasing problem and also, fortunately, increasing awareness, and as exemplified, for example, by the opportunity of being here today to discuss the problem.
The big question is why? I mean, you said it, Dr. Schreffler. I mean, when we were kids, when I was a kid, PB&Js were a staple. Nobody at school had food allergies. Now you've got peanut-free lunchrooms and, you know, restaurants that post the ingredients of their meals, kids carrying EpiPens. I mean, Dr. Gupta, what are the theories about why this is happening?
So currently, they are only theories. I want to definitely make that clear. There is so much more research that we need to understand what exactly these food allergies are and what may be causing it. But some of the popular theories include the hygiene hypothesis. So this theory that as a society we're becoming too clean and our immune systems are not necessarily fighting the things they used to fight. Again, it's a theory. Another one a lot of people talk about these days is, you know, what's changed in how we eat? Is it the pesticides put on food? Is it GMOs? Is it, you know, our guts? Is it the bacteria in our guts? And is that having an influence? And, you know, we're working on really better understanding all of this, yet currently we don't have a definitive answer.
Also, Dr. Schreffler, I'm reading a link between low vitamin D levels and some food allergies.
That's another theory that's out there. There's been an observation that, you know, Increasing latitudes away from the equator seem to be associated with higher rates of allergic disease, including food allergy. Actually, a colleague at Mass General, Carlos Camargo, has worked on that, looking at EpiPen prescriptions in that way. So, yeah, another theory in the mix. But like Dr. Gupta, I would emphasize that, you know, still a lot to learn, and these are really theories being discussed.
So theories, hygiene hypothesis, that we're too clean, that we've so much changed in what we eat, vitamin D theory. You know, why is it so hard to nail this down, Dr. Schreffler?
Well, because it's a very complex problem. I mean, I think the one thing that we can say is that, you know, it is an environmental variable or a mix of environmental variables. So there's sort of a, you know, there is sort of a genetic background. It's true that allergies run in families, and food allergy does occur more often in families who have other allergies. But clearly, you know, with the evidence of the increasing prevalence not only of food allergies but all sorts of allergic disease, and I would add into that mix other immune-related disease, autoimmune disease, you know, we've seen an increase of all of those, and it really points to an environmental factor.
Dr. Gupta, how are food allergies diagnosed, and usually at what age?
So food allergies tend to be diagnosed after a child suffers from a reaction. So a child is at home eating or at school. You know, 1 in 4 actually happen in outside of the home. So a child is eating nuts for the first time and starts developing potentially hives or even more severe symptoms, shortness of breath, throat closing, wheezing, trouble breathing, drop in blood pressure. The parent or the caregiver at that time is scared and calls, you know, 911 or goes into the their doctor's office or the emergency room. And at that point, the diagnosis begins. So if you see a child, you know, having a reaction after eating a food, it's very, very important that that child be taken in to see a physician to better determine whether this is a true food allergy.
Dr. Schreffler, will reactions be the same every time they experience them?
No, they're not so stereotyped as that. You know, there will be symptoms that are most common. Some patients, you know, do seem to have a similar constellation of symptoms most times that they have a reaction. But we know very well that they can vary, and they can vary in severity as well. So that's an important fact, you know, in educating and counseling patients too, because they may have had experienced, you know, a relatively mild reaction and yet be at risk for a more severe reaction subsequently.
And do you know why?
Well, there's a lot of variability, of course, in exposure. You know, we know that the way someone reacts may be associated with the dose that they ingest. That's kind of an obvious feature. But it can also be related to whether they're under the weather at the time. You know, maybe their asthma is a little bit out of control. Maybe it's during the allergy season, things that can modify the severity of a reaction.
Dr. Gupta, can children outgrow a food allergy? And if so, what percentage do?
So yes, they can outgrow food allergy. We call it developing tolerance to a food. And, you know, unfortunately, some of our data has shown that kids are hanging on to their food allergies much longer than was previously thought. Now, of the foods, milk and egg tend to be outgrown the most quickly. And egg, I think, would be number one, followed by milk. Now, peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, finfish, those are the ones that tend to keep going. Only about 10 to 15% of kids outgrow a nut allergy or a fish allergy.
How is it, Dr. Schreffler? I know so many families that are dealing with this, and yet it's one child in the family or two kids in the family. So, and the others, you know, the other one, the other two, nothing. How is it that you can have two kids in one family, one has a terrible food allergy and the other one doesn't? Is there some sort of genetic predisposition?
It's a great question. I mean, there is that genetic predisposition, which I mentioned, and yet we see this rapid apparent increase, suggesting that there's environmental factor as well. Obviously, siblings share a lot of their genes, and yet we see divergence in that phenotype. And even among, you know, twins, they're not necessarily going to be both allergic. And furthermore, the genetic risk seems to be, you know, the development of a food allergy of some sort, not necessarily the same food. So it's not necessarily the case that because a parent was allergic, say, to milk, that, you know, milk allergy is going to be a higher risk for a child, but some allergy will be at higher risk. Mm.
Dr. Gupta, what are the biggest misconceptions about food allergies in kids?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions, which I would really like to, you know, stop, is that the word allergy. You know, oftentimes when we think of environmental allergies, we think of, you know, the runny nose, itchy eyes, and we kind of tie in allergies to food to be similar, which they're very, very different. And food allergies really work on the skin oftentimes. So you can have the hives, the rash, but then they can progress quickly into the respiratory symptoms. So those symptoms of wheezing or trouble breathing, and even into the cardiovascular system, and then potentially lead to death. And so I think really understanding that word allergy, you know, oftentimes we call those severe symptoms anaphylaxis, but you don't know if a child is going to have a mild or severe reaction at any time. And so I think really understanding how severe it is critical. And also, I think people don't understand that there currently is no cure. It's not like a seasonal allergy where you can take your antihistamine and go to school and be relatively okay and be protected. There are no medications these kids can take currently to protect themselves from an accidental ingestion or a severe reaction.
And Dr. Schreffler, food allergy is different from food intolerance.
It is. So food allergies are actually a subset of, you know, a number of ways that someone might feel sick after eating a food. And you mentioned lactose sort of in the opening. You know, lactose intolerance, which is really the inability to digest that, you know, milk sugar, is distinct from a food allergy, which is a subset of adverse reactions that are caused by the immune system. Mm-hmm. So the most common ones that we talk mostly about and that we've focused on so far are those that are, you know, potentially immediate, if, you know, associated with IgE, but there are other kinds of food allergies as well.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the rise in food allergies among children in this country today, possible causes, possible treatments. Joining me in the studio this hour in Boston is Dr. Wayne Schreffler, director of the Food Allergy Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, and from Chicago, Illinois, Dr. Ruchi Gupta, professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and a clinical attending physician at the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. I want to play some sound here. This is early March of this year. 19-year-old Cameron Fitzpatrick died after accidentally being exposed to peanut oil. His parents, Chris and Robin Fitzpatrick, spoke to Boston's WCVB's Pam Cross.
He ate peanut oil, and it took his life.
Cam, who had severe nut allergies and was asthmatic, died on Friday at Jordan Hospital.
So, I mean, I shoved peanut butter down my throat like it's nothing. It's amazing that that can do that to somebody.
His parents don't blame the friend who offered him a cookie.
He inquired a few times, you think it's all right to eat it? You don't smell peanut butter or anything. And all I can say is within the half hour after that, I watched my son suffer awful, awful, struggling to breathe and begging for help.
Dr. Schreffler, I mean, it's sometimes you just don't know, right, what you're giving kids and if it could be a problem. Dr. Schreffler?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly, you know, tragic when something like that occurs. And, you know, it's often, as may have been the case there, I don't know, there were sort of, you know, I don't know all the details of the case, kind of a perfect storm of events that occurs. And, of course, it's our primary obligation as clinicians to, you know, adequately prepare families to, you know, avoid those situations and cope with, you know, responding when necessary. And fortunately, there are good tools, you know, at hand to prevent those outcomes. And, you know, epinephrine auto-injectors, that's why they're so important, is because these things can and do happen.
EpiPens.
Yeah, that's right. But when, you know, administered promptly at the first signs of symptoms that are involving the airways or cardiovascular system, they are absolutely life-saving. And that's an important message as well.
Dr. Gupta, talk about management of food allergies in children. Where do you start?
So anyone who witnesses any type of reaction happening in a child should immediately stay with the child and ask them, you know, how they're feeling. But if they see something progressing quickly like it did in this child, the epinephrine auto-injector is critical. That is first line. So having people around the child trained on how to use it. It's a very simple device. There's two on the market now, so there's even a choice. But it's very simple in terms of, you know, pulling the safety guard and then putting it in the lateral thigh and holding it for 10 seconds and then releasing it. And a couple key things to know is you can put it over clothing. It doesn't mean you have to undress a child. And you can't. You will never see the needle. The needle will never be visible to the child or to the adult. So that fear should hopefully somewhat decrease.
Dr. Schreffler, what would you add?
Well, the other piece of that is the avoidance, of course. So, you know, consistently reading labels and, you know, educating our patients about how to effectively avoid allergens that they're at risk from is the other key part. So it's both. It's, you know, effective avoidance and emergency plan in place to treat when accidents happen.
This is not just for parents, too. Often you're teaching, mm-hmm. you know, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds about how to do this.
Well, there's an, you know, there's an age-appropriate, you know, development that takes place as children are older and take more ownership over managing their food allergies themselves. And that's different for different kids. Usually, you know, they're not going to have the responsibility of self-administering epinephrine until they're a bit older than that. But, you know, it's a conversation that has to begin with the family, and it takes, you know, a pace that is appropriate for each family and child.
Dr. Gupta.
Yes, I completely agree. You know, I personally am affected by food allergy. I have two children, one an older son without food allergy and a younger daughter who's 6 now who has food allergies. And I see it in her every day. I mean, it's so critical. They can't necessarily administer the epinephrine auto-injector, but she's practiced it multiple times and she knows how to do it. Mm. And she advocates for herself. And I think it's critical to teach your children to advocate for themselves, to know, ask, you know, what is in this and am I allowed to eat it? And if there's any fear whatsoever, to not take a chance.
Let's get some calls in here. I've got a lot of them. First, from Andover, Massachusetts, Jay is on the line. Hi, Jay. Welcome.
Hi, Jean. Thanks for taking my call. This conversation definitely hits home hard. And one thing that my wife and I definitely struggle with is the psychological effects, because everything is so food-centric, from family events to school events to going over friends' houses. I've administered an EpiPen twice to my daughter. And I know that it saved her life. One just recently, 2 weeks ago, while we were down in Mexico. Mm. It's an issue that we deal with every day. Not to mention the psychological effects on her, as well as my other daughter, who doesn't have any food allergies. Mm. And I don't know if your panel has any advice or ideas of how to deal with this, because you just want the one with food allergies to feel like everyone else, and it's tough where you just can't go out for an ice cream cone or you can't go to, most places.
Even birthday parties for these little kids sometimes. Jay, thank you very much. Dr. Gupta, would you respond?
Yeah, I feel what you're going through. I mean, it is such a significant issue because food allergy is so different than other chronic diseases because food is a part of absolutely everything we do. And a couple things that I would recommend, though, are, you know, really make your child feel good about how responsible they are and secure in the fact that, you know, they have safe places. And that may be your home, but oftentimes, and now it's expanding, there are allergen-safe places to eat, ice cream shops, bakeries, and even restaurants. And if you find the few, you know, it doesn't take a lot, but if you have your list of places that are completely safe and your child can feel very good and safe about being there, I think that really helps a child. One thing, you know, we did talk to many children. We published a book on this, and it talks about the child's emotions on not only can it help them and cause anxiety and have these negative factors, but what we've noticed in these kids is as they grow up, they become incredibly responsible adults. Mm. And that responsibility really expands throughout their life, not only in how they manage their food allergy. Mm. And so from a lot of older children with food allergy, we have found that they do turn out to be very strong, independent, and responsible human beings, which is nice to see, a positive part of food allergy.
Dr. Schreffler, right. I've personally seen a friend of my little first grader reading food labels. You know, she's 6. Mm-hmm. And I can't eat that because, look, this is in it. You know, I mean, you are getting a sense of responsibility very young. Unfortunately, a difficult situation too.
And it's best a sense of empowerment. And I think that Ruchi makes an excellent point that is really a key coping skill to develop, and actually will be leveraged into advantage in other domains as well, I think. And we see, you know, these kids, they grow up, they thrive, absolutely. And, you know, it's really, you know, all of us are to some extent negotiating, you know, risk versus activity. And for families with and patients with food allergies, it's, you know, one more huge thing. Food is so central to our culture, but it definitely can be managed, and there are good tools out there. The anxiety piece is also huge, and, you know, I think that, you know, when that anxiety becomes overly generalized, so, you know, if a child starts expressing fear around eating, you know, more broadly, et cetera, you know, make an intervention, you know, at our food allergy center and at many places, there'll be, you know, a pediatric psychologist to consult with to focus on that issue. And it's a common comorbidity and it needs to be addressed as well.
Dr. Gupta, what about the downsides of having such significant issues with food and what you can eat?
Yeah, and there are so many downsides. One key thing is to make sure that your child always has safe snacks that they take places so they don't feel completely left out and they don't have anything to eat. And oftentimes, you know, when my child takes her safe snacks, the other kids want them. So making them good and making them, you know, something that they enjoy eating and are proud of eating. Another thing is, you know, I really think it's critical that a child has a really strong support network. And that may mean having a party at your home with some of their closest friends, explaining what food allergy is, teaching them about the EpiPen, and, you know, making it fun, but making sure those kids understand that any time your child is around food, that they support them and they may ask for them. You know, she can't eat peanuts, so got to make sure that doesn't have it. We have found that especially as kids get older in that risk-taking stage when they're getting into high school and they don't want to talk about their food allergies and they really just want to go out and have pizza with their friends, having a strong support network really helps them ask those questions and stay safe.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation at this point. Joining me from Scituate, Massachusetts, is Paul Antico, founder and CEO of AllergyEats.com, a guide to allergy-friendly restaurants across the United States. Three of his five kids have food allergies. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you? Tell me the kinds of house rules that you have concerning food and food allergies in your home.
Well, with so many children, We don't restrict any particular foods in our house except for peanuts, peanuts and tree nuts, which have been shown to be anaphylactic in two of our children. One of my children also has a dairy allergy. Two of them have egg, and one has sesame. But we don't restrict the other children from having milk or eggs in the house. We just make sure that any activity that we partake in, if there's a cake, that there's something special for all the children. Mm-hmm. In fact, actually, within the house, my wife, who is quite a baker, has become very good at making cakes and other treats without egg and without any of the other trigger foods.
Well, I know that this has really changed your life when you left your job, essentially, to start this AllergyEats.org online website, among other things. What's its mission?
The goal is twofold. One, it's to help other families navigate an experience that we had trouble with, which is finding allergy-friendly restaurants wherever we travel. And I would note that I say allergy-friendly instead of allergy-safe because you take a risk every time you dine out, even in the home. But we're trying to give families with food allergies a guide to those restaurants that have proven to be the most accommodating to families with food allergies. And the other thing that I hope AllergyEats.com helps accomplish is I hope it helps incent restaurateurs to become more allergy-friendly. My background in finance has allowed me to speak to restaurateurs and show them, frankly, at their level, you know, how much more money they can make, how much more profitable they can be by accommodating our community. And I don't think that's anything that they should be ashamed of. I can tell you, you know, in my circumstance and in almost everyone I've spoken to, we're fine with restaurants making more money if they can give us a safer experience. Mm-hmm.
Some parents of kids, as you well know, Paul, who don't have food allergies, complain that school policies go too far, that it's costly and it's inconvenient, and that they have to substitute, you know, sometimes pricier options for milk and peanut butter alternatives because, you know, some kids in the cafeteria have food allergies. Have you encountered that, and what's your response to it?
I haven't encountered it personally. We've been really lucky. My kids go to a school called the Inley School in Scituate, which is extraordinarily allergy-friendly. But I've experienced people in schools at both ends of the spectrum. There are those where the community just understands and the administration and the faculty really understand that they have an obligation to allow these children to learn in a safe environment. I have also experienced the examples such as you've referred to. And in those cases, I think it's most important for the parents of the individual with a food allergy to go in and speak in a rational manner with the administration, the faculty, and even the other parents, rather than go in with, you know, guns a-blazing, saying, hey, you can't do this, you can't do that. People don't respond well to that. But what we've found is if you explain the situation, you provide the facts, you provide, you know, the background and everything, mm-hmm. that that individuals will be quite responsive to that. It just sometimes it takes some time, but once it gets going, the trend is generally our friend, so to speak.
Can these precautions, can some of them be taken too far at times?
Absolutely. There are children, as Dr. Schreffler and Dr. Gupta have noted, there is a big eight of food allergies, but the number of food allergies can go well over 200. You can't prevent, unless you prevent food being in the classroom, which I know some people advocate, and I'm not going to agree or disagree with them. Everyone's got their opinion. But so long as there is food in the school, you can't just tell everyone not to bring in every allergen on the face of the earth. So you can go too far. You really have to set some rational and reasonable goals with the administration of the school, and that's going to make it much more palatable to the other families as well.
Paul Antico, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate very much. Good luck with AllergyEats.com.
Thank you very much.
Let's go back to the phones. Leslie's in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Leslie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. My question has to do a little bit with what I see as a contradiction in dealing with allergies. With all three of my children have food allergies, specifically tree nut allergies. And this was discovered later. So while they're extremely allergic to things like pecans and walnuts, they have eaten almonds and coconut and other things all their life with no problem. So they've been told a way to stay from all tree nuts as a general category. So we've bundled them together and said, stay away. But I also understand that treatments are being done where you give small amounts to build up tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just a little bit confused. Those two things don't seem to sync together with me. And I was wondering if they had any thoughts about where treatment's going.
Excellent, Leslie.
Why you would...
I really appreciate the call. Yes, Dr. Schreffler, pick it up there.
Yeah, it's a great question. It is, I think, often perceived as a contradiction for families and probably for good reason. I mean, so in fact, for example, for a young child, where they're going to be learning to read labels and the label is going to say may contain traces of tree nuts and not specify, a particular nut, there is a case to be made for sort of treating that as a class because that's in fact how the food industry treats them in some ways. However, that said, I do not personally advocate for my patients that, especially as they get older and they understand the nuances more fully, that they necessarily avoid a whole class of foods because they're allergic to some of the foods that are in that class. So I don't think that is necessary in terms of clinical care. And then the question of whether or not, in fact, there may be some benefit of, for example, eating almond while still strictly avoiding cashew or pecan or some other nut, that's trickier and is often mixed in people's minds with this concept of oral immunotherapy, just as the caller has done in the phrasing of the question. There may be reasons that having something like almond in the diet for someone who tolerates while they're allergic to another nut is reducing the likelihood of that person becoming allergic to, almond later in life. But we don't really know that. I mean, when I talk to patients about this issue, I emphasize that probably good for them to have almond just because they probably could enjoy it and they can find it safely, not cross-contaminated, and de-emphasize kind of the desensitization aspect of it, which I would love to talk about more.
We will, after the break.
Right.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the rising number of people, kids, with food allergies in this country. Joining me in the studio this hour is Dr. Wayne Schreffler, a pediatrician and director of the Food Allergy Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, principal investigator at Center for Immunology and Inflammatory Diseases, also at Mass General, professor of pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School. And joining me from Chicago, Illinois, is Dr. Ruchi Gupta, professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and a clinical attending physician at the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Here's another clip, some more sound from March 11th, 2011. This is a report on CNN. Parents at a school in Edgewater, Florida, push back on strict food allergy accommodations for a six-year-old with a peanut allergy at the school. To protect the girl, students in her class at Edgewater were required to wash their hands before entering the classroom in the morning, after lunch, and also to rinse out their mouths. Here is one parent.
It's frustrating and it's time consuming and it's distracting them and taking away from their education. We were all, as parents, okay with those procedures. But then as first grade has gone on and progressed, they keep implementing new procedures that now at this point we feel are unfair.
Dr. Gupta, speak to this a little bit. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, do schools have a legal obligation to protect students with food allergies?
So they should protect children with food allergies. And all schools, all public schools, require children who have any chronic disease or disability to fill out what we call a 504 plan, which really sits down with the parents and talks through what accommodations does this child need. You know, I understand the pushback. It is difficult. I remember when my son, before I had a daughter with food allergies, he loved peanut butter and jelly. And to restrict that from his lunch really meant, you know, made it very difficult for us. So I understand how other parents may feel. Now, I think what is so important is for all parents to understand how severe this could be and what exactly a food allergy is. But, you know, putting restrictions such as peanut-free or, you know, no peanuts allowed is really difficult to do in schools because there's no peanut detector when kids bring in food. And so there's no 100% way of knowing that there is no peanut butter in a child's snack or food. So
I was going to say, Dr. Schreffler, how do you strike the balance and what counts as quote-unquote discrimination against a child with food allergies?
I think you strike the balance really by having, you know, a rational, as much as possible, evidence-based discussion. And I always encourage, you know, families to start there, you know, talk with the school. Things have really only improved over time. And to focus on, you know, where the risks are. I mean, frankly, you know, the risks are not so much about, you know, even accidentally getting, you know, some contact exposure. The risks have mostly to do with accidentally ingesting something. And it can be absolutely a trace amount. And policies like washing hands and surfaces after meals are quite appropriate, or being very thoughtful and limiting, you know, food in the classroom. They're very appropriate. But it's a conversation, and it's not going to be sort of a one-size-fits-all for all schools and all families. It's focusing on where the risks are greatest, which are accidental ingestion, and putting in place policies that make sense for that school and that child to prevent that. And on the other hand, you know, on the other side of that, being prepared and educated about how to respond to accidental reactions, because they will likely occur. The goal is not zero risk. The goal is to mitigate risk as much as reasonably possible and be prepared when accidents happen, because they will happen. And a great resource out there, by the way, for schools, you know, to sort of get more educated about this is a colleague of mine who has a site, schools.allergyhome.org. I highly recommend it.
Well, this is so new, and so many schools are sort of just grappling with this. 8% of American kids now struggling with food allergies, Dr. Gupta. I mean, a lot of them are just kind of figuring this out on the fly, I guess.
Right. But as Dr. Schreffler pointed out, there are resources. Allergy Home is a great resource, as is the Food Allergy Research and Education Organization, which is FARE, F-A-R-E, and it's www.foodallergy.org. And they have a lot of great resources on their site, too. So parents are not completely alone. I mean, one critical thing for schools is, as Dr. Schreffler said, is have policies in place. And one thing that's been happening with policies is this epinephrine, school access to epinephrine legislation. And as you mentioned, a child dying, that had happened here in Chicago, and the Chicago Public Schools really took action and currently have epinephrine auto-injectors in all Chicago public schools, protecting 400,000 students. And I can tell you, since September to date, 25 of those epinephrine auto-injectors have already been used. So it does show how important this policy is.
Yeah, absolutely. If I could just add to that, you know, we've been collaborating with Ann Sheets at the Commonwealth of Massachusetts schools in the Department of Health, and together with Michael Pistoner, and it's remarkable the number of reactions that occur in individuals in the school setting who don't have a prior diagnosis. Mm. It's also legislation pending here, and I encourage people to support that.
Mm. Back to the phones. Alan's in Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, Alan. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for covering the subject. And Dr. Gupta, I appreciate you bringing out some of the overlooked points. You know, we call it an allergy, but it's the reaction is far worse than someone's worst runny nose or what we commonly think of as an allergy, and the legal ramifications haven't been hit upon, because like no one sues nature for pollen, but if someone says, hey, there's no dill on this hamburger, and yet it arrives with dill, take it off, they bring it back, and the person has a reaction, there can be there could be legal ramifications.
I hear you, Alan. Let's turn it to the doctor. Dr. Schreffler, Dr. Gupta, I'll turn to you in Chicago first. What about those legal ramifications? Restaurant workers, what about a church function or some such thing where, you know, this is a peanut-free environment? Well, in reality, it's not.
Yeah, and that's the fear of saying something is peanut-free. I mean, why do the labeling laws currently, you know, when almost any product you pick up in the grocery store says may contain or may be processed in? And, you know, what's the real reason for that? I mean, it's the fear of if by chance there was even a trace amount and the child had a reaction, there could be legal ramifications. And so I think that fear of promising that this has nothing is really hard for any restaurant or manufacturer to do.
Dr. Schreffler, how do you see the food industry handling these issues?
Well, I think that Mr. Antico from Allergy Eats, you know, hit upon, you know, probably the goal being allergy friendly. And that, you know, in many ways, and this is true for, you know, the food industry, it's kind of incumbent upon us, I would say, in the medical research community to provide better data about things like, you know, what are safe versus dangerous thresholds of allergen. Again, I don't think realistically the goal can be zero. I think the goal has to be evidence behind, you know, what exposures are so small that they're not dangerous and what exposures are dangerous even for the most sensitive people, and give people guidance to direct things around that.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Betsy is on the line. Thanks for waiting, Betsy. Welcome.
Thanks. So my question has to do also with the peanut allergy. And I'm curious if the doctors have any information about children in malnourishment situations that are given those peanut butter packs for, you know, emergency to bring them back to life, basically, when they're almost starved. Of course, that's not in this country generally that we see that, but I'll see news stories sometimes about that. And I've always wondered, do those children react to peanuts in the same percentages as children that we're talking about in this country?
Betsy, thank you. Dr. Gupta.
Yeah, I think I've seen and questioned the same thing. And they did ask those countries where they do provide those packets. I remember them asking, you know, have you noticed any reactions? Because we don't advocate that children at such young ages have peanuts due to allergies. And they said their response was pretty much, you know, they have much bigger things to fight right now than to worry about that. So there's two things. One, I don't think they were noticing it. But even if they were, even if a child did have a reaction, how many of those kids would actually be thought to have died of a reaction to peanut? But we don't notice as much food allergy in underserved countries, although it is rising. But this could be due to the fact that it's not diagnosed, or the hygiene hypothesis. You know, maybe it's not there because their immune systems are pretty busy.
Dr. Schreffler, I'm reading a piece on Reuters just today. Kids and teens who are born abroad and immigrate to the U.S. are about half as likely to have asthma and allergies as those who are born in the U.S.
Right, right. And I know that, again, in this area of sort of epidemiological studies, Dr. Gupta can comment even more authoritatively. But yeah, and we see this anecdotally certainly. And yet, you know, in sort of the first, you know, that second generation here, very quickly acquire rates of allergies and food allergies similar to the U.S. population. So, again, pointing to an environmental factor, you know, playing a big role. You know, it's interesting. There is no longer a recommendation per se to restrict peanut, you know, even in high-risk children here in the U.S., you know, from their diets. I mean, that recommendation had been dropped. You know, it's kind of what, you know, I grew up on, so to speak, you know, when I was doing my training 12 years ago. And And it's disarming to parents. You know, what do you mean? There's no recommendation to, you know, not give my 11-month-old or my, you know, not 11 months, but 18-month-old peanut or something like that. But in fact, you know, there's research going on right now intentionally giving peanut flour to you know, young children with the goal of promoting tolerance. So there's just so much we don't know about the relationship between early exposure and risk for development
Does
of allergy
that go
later.
Back to that point of the oral immunization, taking something early in bits to create some sort of immunity or build immunity over time?
It's related, I would say, although the difference is that, you know, in the case of active peanut oral immunotherapy, we're trying to treat people who have established disease. In the case of the research I mentioned, which is being led by Gideon Lack in the UK and has funding from the Immune Tolerance Network and other organizations, it's really a prevention strategy. So it's a little bit different. There, you know, there's not a pre-existing diagnosis, and the goal is to reduce the, you know, the incidence of disease. In the case of what we and others are, you know, doing around the country, supported in many cases by FAIR, it's trying to treat active disease.
I see. Let's go to Shelley, Burlington, Connecticut. Hi, Shelley, you're on.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I am 44. When I was about 4 or 5, I was diagnosed. And I think, I don't believe by a doctor, I believe it was just trial and error with my parents as having severe food allergies to almonds, pecans, walnuts, and sesame. And through the years, we've figured out that I'm also allergic to flax and rye. I've had every reaction under the sun, I'm pretty sure, and they're never the same twice. They're always different.
Did you grow out of it?
No, I didn't, no. Luckily, you know, as an adult, I am one of those people who grew up with the food allergies and now try to be very responsible. I still make mistakes where I've purchased a package of something and I, for whatever reason, overlook the ingredient that will then make me sick or send me to the hospital.
I hear it.
But it's few and far between at this point.
Shelley, I'm glad you called. Here's Liz in Kensington, Connecticut. Liz, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi. Well, every conversation is about kids with food allergies, and it's really frustrating being an adult with a food allergy. And I was wondering if the experts had anything to say about being an adult with a food allergy, because obviously these kids are going to grow up to be adults, and especially I work in a high school. These kids are going to have to navigate a high school cafeteria where nobody gives a crap if you have a food allergy.
Liz, thank you. This is near and dear to me. Dr. Schreffler,
yeah.
What do you say about adult onset allergies?
Great question. Adult onset as well as persistence of allergies into adults, as Dr. Gupta mentioned at the top, you know, we see evidence of more persistent allergy as well as adult onset allergy that help explain, you know, the kind of growing prevalence in the adult population. And, you know, and fortunately, I mean, here in the Boston area, for example, I've, you know, participated in events with several of the local colleges. I mean, there is growing awareness in the nutrition services of institutions like that, and even some employers, you know, large employers that, for example, serve food. And so there's some growing awareness about that, but it's a big issue. And we do know that some adults will, you know, have onset of allergy, you know, later in life, most often to nuts and shellfish, but it can be to just about everything. One of the things we haven't talked about yet, but, you know, the most common form of food allergies in adults is, you know, something called oral allergy syndrome, which is the mechanism of which is a little bit different. That's when someone first becomes allergic to environmental allergens, plant, you know, pollen-borne allergens, and then subsequently has cross-reactivity, as it's called, you know, usually limited, more mild reactions of itching in the mouth, et cetera, to proteins that are related to those pollen allergens. Mm. And that, in a way, actually adds to sort of the, some of the diagnostic confusion out there as well.
Mm. Dr. Gupta, wrap us up here about pediatric research and where you see it going. We've talked so much about, you know, we don't really know why this is all happening. There are, you know, there are theories, but nothing substantial. Where do you see this playing out?
Yeah, research is so critical. And what the good news is that it is increasing and there is more awareness and hopefully more funding for food allergy research. You know, a lot of great studies looking for a cure or a treatment to that Dr. Schreffler and many others around the country are doing. But we do also need to really focus in on, you know, what is causing this increase, what environmental factors are causing it in order to prevent it just from the start. But the good news is there's a lot of us doing this research. And, you know, just to second what that last caller said, I mean, it is critical not only for kids, but all through adulthood. I mean, we are working in the environment in restaurants, in schools, but also in colleges and in workplaces, in airplanes. I mean, there needs to be awareness everywhere a child or an adult with food allergy goes. And I'm excited about the future.
Dr. Schreffler, you have the last word.
The research is critical. You know, I'm really pleased to see the NIH stepping up and trying to address the relative, differential, disproportionate lack of research in this area. They're really eager, you know, support, I would say, you know, the NIH and federal funding for research. It's incredibly important, as well as organizations like Food Allergy Research and Education. And at the same time, as important as I think that is, and that's exactly my wheelhouse, we have the tools in place right now to help kids thrive. And I think that that's critically important to get out there. If you haven't already seen your allergist, if it's been a while, go see them. Get plugged into the tools that you need to do well with this problem.
Dr. Wayne Schreffler, a director of the Food Allergy Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, pediatrician there and principal investigator at the Center for Immunology and Inflammatory Disease, also professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Thanks so much, doctor. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Dr. Ruchi Gupta from Chicago, pediatrician, professor of pediatrics at Northwestern Medical School. Really appreciate your time and expertise, doctor. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.